Conversations of Imam Musa al-Gadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Gadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Gadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Gadhim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Gadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Gadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Gadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Gadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: اللهم إني أسألك العافية، وأسألك جميل العافية، وأسألك شكر العافية، وأسألك شكر شكر العافية.
Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam stated, O Allah, verily I ask you for vitality, and I ask you for gracious vitality. And I ask you for the ability to thank you for your vitality. And I ask you for thankfulness for having granted me the ability to thank you for vitality.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, when we are talking about the beautiful conversations and the dialogues of the seventh divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Gadhim alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence spoke about certain lifestyle guidelines, or these guidelines for not just Shias, but for Muslims in general, and really for all of humanity. Guidelines which can truly help us to change our lives for the better. Now, in this conversation, one of the companions of Imam al-Gadhim alayhi salam, Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salam, one of his companions asked him that, you know, how can we make a barrier or refrain ourselves from committing sins and committing offenses? Now, it's quite a all-encompassing and big question, right? And it's a question that's very relative to our lives as well. Now, what can we do really in order to prevent ourselves from sinning, especially if we live in countries where it is very, very easy to sin? Case in point, Western countries or some other countries in the world in which committing sin is easier than breathing air. Yes, in Muslim countries it is a little bit more difficult to commit these sins. But anyways, in general, we are talking about how do we prevent ourselves from committing sins. And so in reply, Imam al-Gadhim alayhi salam says, the remembrance of death is a barrier against sins and offenses. Allahu Akbar. And dear friends, we find that the more we think about and reflect upon the words of the divinely appointed Imams, and in this case, the seventh divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that it is really not just true, but it is almost like a perfect truth, or rather it is a perfect truth. Every time that we want to go commit a sin, we want to lie, or we want to, you know, do something that is haram, do something that is prohibited, or we want to cheat, or we want to manipulate, or we want to deceive, or we want to steal, or I mean the countless different kinds of sins that a human being might become weak enough to commit. If you really remember death, that you will die, that all of this temporary and fake and imaginary pleasure that we think we will receive from this sin, it will end. It will end in just a few fleeting seconds. And death is a reality, and then the grave is a reality, and then the questioning of the hereafter is a reality, and the heaven and the hell is a reality. It is interesting, these are the things that are said in the Talqeen, this reminder when a person dies and upon the dead body they recite these things to remind the dead body that Allah is truth, the Qur'an is truth, the Messenger of Allah is truth, the Ahlul Bayt is truth, the Qur'an is truth, death is truth, barzakh and the so-called purgatory, for lack of a better word at this point in time, is truth. When we realize all these things, then committing sin becomes much harder, and thus the remembrance of death becomes a barrier against sins. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
The aspect of, or I should say, one of the aspects that made the imamah of Imam al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, very critical is the conditions that ended up being the conditions of the ummah and the conditions of the movements of the Ahlul Bayt during that period. And this is, by the time of Imam al-Kadhim, we can say this was pretty much now apparent. Imam al-Sadiq, salamullah alayhi, had a very difficult time to get across to people the notion that this government that has been established is not the government of the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet, as the Prophet mentioned. The Abbasids are not the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet. He had an important role in that. He played that role very well, and that led to his assassination. If I want to briefly mention that, the Abbasids came up and they came to power based on the slogan related to the Ahlul Bayt, and the people were rallied up against the Umayyads, being explained what the Umayyads have done to the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet. And obviously the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet are the children of his daughter, at least they're included. That wasn't something that anyone could hide. Now that the Abbasids have come to power, they are, according to what they have said, and people think that they are the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet. They're the ones that have authority on behalf of the Prophet. They are true successors of the Prophet. They are just rulers. They're not going to be ruling unjustly as the Umayyads did. One of the most important things for them would be not to take the life of one of the clear members of the family of the Prophet, Imam al-Sadiq, salamullah alayhi, someone who was well known. But eventually, because of the activities of the Imam in exposing the true nature of who the Abbasids were, and that they were not the Ahlul Bayt, and the effectiveness of those words, and the effectiveness of the stances, the strategies, the tactics of the Imam in bringing that awareness to the masses and the fear of it becoming a more serious problem than it already had caused Abu Ja'far al-Mansur, la'natullah alayh, to poison the Imam. Many times he intended to prior to that. He didn't, and eventually he got to it and he poisoned Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayh.
Listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
In the limelight.
Four corporations control 90% of the baby formula market in the United States. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Amy Goodman and Dennis Moynihan writers. This article is published under the heading, The U.S. Corporate Monopolies Who Stole the Baby's Formula. Here's the story. Last October, a whistleblower sent the FDA a report detailing safety and sanitation violations at the Abbott Nutrition Factory in Sturgis, Michigan, the largest baby formula manufacturing plant in the U.S. It would be months before the FDA took action. Abbott fired the whistleblower. Four babies who had consumed formula from the plant suffered bacterial infections. Two of them died. The FDA could not conclusively link the illnesses or deaths to the plant. In February, Abbott shut down the plant and announced a voluntary recall of its Sturgis-manufactured baby formula. The FDA followed with a product warning. The life-threatening formula shortage was not due to a natural disaster or circumstances beyond Abbott's control. Rather, it is a predictable outcome of corporate greed, a cover-up, and a captured regulatory agency. Four corporations control 90% of the baby formula market in the United States. Abbott Labs, which produces Similac, leads with 40%, followed by Rickett, which makes Enfamil and Lysil at 30% of the market. The Biden administration is facing mounting criticism for its delay in addressing the Sturgis plant's health and safety concerns and for failing to anticipate the formula shortages caused by the plant's closure. In many cases, infant formula is a vital necessity, providing life-saving nutrition for thousands of babies in the U.S., for whom breastfeeding is not possible due to allergies, immune conditions, or other situations. Parents of color are more likely to use formula in the first 3 months of an infant's life than white parents. The whistleblower report was received by the FDA in October, but the whistleblower was not interviewed until December. The whistleblower's report was released publicly last month in a House Appropriations Committee hearing chaired by Democratic Congressmember Rosa DeLauro. The report stated lax practices, including regulatory violations, were consistently overlooked and described a pervasive fear of retaliation for those who dared to rock the boat. Following the hearing, DeLauro said in a statement, "The FDA is a regulatory agency, period. It is about time they acted like one." David Dayen, executive editor of the American Prospect, explained how these few large corporations obtain their power over the infant formula market with the help of an essential federal program, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. Quote, "The reason is that we have a program called Women, Infants, and Children, the WIC program, and about half of all formula passes through that program and goes to poor families. It's very well intentioned. The government gets very large discounts for purchasing formula and getting it to poor families. But each state does a competitive bidding process with a formula company. And in exchange for those volume discounts, they get market exclusively. So what you end up having is these little monopolies in all 50 states," unquote. Formula is critical for the proper nutrition of many babies, but is generally considered less beneficial than breastfeeding. The Lancet Medical Journal issued a comprehensive series on the benefits of breastfeeding in 2016, finding that the deaths of 823,000 children and 20,000 mothers each year could be averted through universal breastfeeding, along with economic savings of $300 billion. The series confirms the benefits of breastfeeding in fewer infections, increased intelligence, probable protection against overweight and diabetes, and cancer prevention for mothers. Breast milk, the series concludes, makes the world healthier, smarter, and more equal. David Dayen, in his book, Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power, describes how the U.S. regime has bullied countries in the global south that try to promote breastfeeding over formula. At a 2018 meeting of the UN-affiliated World Health Assembly, Ecuador's proposed resolution to protect, promote, and support breastfeeding was gutted by the U.S. delegation, which threatened to withhold aid to any nation opposing the U.S. stance. The U.S. delegates, Dayen writes, were operating on behalf of the $70 billion deeply concentrated global baby formula industry. After signing a long-delayed consent decree with the FDA, Abbott is expected to reopen its Sturgis plant as soon as this weekend, potentially alleviating the worst of this crisis by the end of July. Meanwhile, this corporate formula cartel profiting off babies' bellies while feeding at the public trough must be reined in, constrained by effective regulation and empowered consumers.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
خدا رحمت کنه مرحوم آیاست مهدی قوام رو. ایشون یزد منبر رفته بود یه دهه محرم.
May Allah bless the soul of the late Agha Sayyid Mahdi Qawam. He was among the greatest faithful scholars of contemporary Iran. It is narrated that once he gave sermons in the city of Yazd and he was paid 62 tumans as the gift. When back to the city of Tehran, he and his friend went to one of the poor areas of Tehran. Sayyid Mahdi gave his gift of 62 tumans to his friend and asked him to go to one of the houses in the poor area and give it to them. Sayyid's friend went to the house and gave the pocket of the money to the needy family and they became very much happy. On their way back home, the late Sayyid Mahdi Qawam told his friend, Can you lend me 5 tumans to buy thumbsings for the house?
مؤمن اینه گرفتاری توی مؤمن دیگری میبینه بیخیال نیست این محک ایمانه
This is a true believer. He sacrifices himself for others. Stories like what happened to Sayyid Qawam are the test of faith for the believers. If you want to test your faith, you have to see how much responsible you are towards your brothers and sisters in faith. Especially at the times of hardships, we have to be concerned about the problems of our brothers and sisters in faith. In such situations, Allah will shower His mercy upon us too. Therefore, we as Muslims must not let our relations to be weakened. We must not let Satan destroy our relations in the society. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haider, bringing you back to reality. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sister Zainab Sadat.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brother. I'm really glad to participate in this discussion today.
God bless you. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you.
And on this side, we have brother Yasser Ibrahim.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
It's
a pleasure being with you.
It's good to have you. So we're talking about something which is potentially depressing, all right, especially for those of us who are getting older. All right. And the question is this: what experiences and what things in life actually change the way that we view it? In other words, what do we learn as we get older? What do we understand about life in particular as we get older? I mean, there's some things that you can learn from books and from other places, from experiences that others have had. But I feel like there are some things that you can only learn from your own experience, and you need to have age to have experience. Sister, what's your opinion on this, your immediate thoughts on this?
Well, I believe entering the period of senescence is quite interesting and weird at the same time, because it's, for me at least, it is an indicative of somehow it's an alarm that your time to live is just coming to its end.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I guess the old people start to realize and observe the world in a different way. That is why the religion has emphasized our respecting for those old people, because I think that their view of the world is quite different from us as young people.
She called us young people.
You know, when I get old, when some person gets old, he or she comes to see the world in a different way that is respectable, that point of view is respectable, and somehow it could be considered as the right way of discerning life.
Mm.
And one difference between these people's view and ours, which is immature, is their life experience that comes to their views and comes to their minds. You know, life experience, for example, there are lots of things that for me as a young person or for lots of people are quite worthy, and they're worth a try, they're worth money, they're worth spending energy. But for an old person, all those things might seem quite worthless and unimportant. They just come to say that, oh my God, you're spending your money on buying that new car. Why are you doing that? A car's use is to take you to some places, and you can do it on the cheap cars.
That's
as well.
Really, Yasser, the sister mentioned about how it's an Islamic concept to respect the elderly. I'd like to get your take on that first. And the second idea that the sister alluded to is the concept of things becoming worthless in their eyes for a certain age.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think age, when it comes to the outlook or a view of a person, depends on how that look is taken. For example, I'm sure in our lives we've seen certain people who are quite elderly, but yet they are the same as they were 50 years ago. What is in worth to them now is same as it was 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They have not changed in any way. They have not looked forward. They've stayed in a particular bubble, and they've kept in that bubble. They have not moved. I know certain people, for example, that, you know, they may have had a near-death experience, but that hadn't changed them. Mm-hmm. You know, they continued on the same, you know, path. There's a very nice Quranic example before we get to the second one. The glorious Quran speaks about Abu Lahab. Abu Lahab wasn't a young man. He wasn't.
Mm.
He was very old. Obviously, the Prophet's uncle. May have been in his 40s, 50s, and so on. When the Quran mentions Tabbat Yada Abi Lahab, he will be one of those who will be in the fire. So it's a warning to him. It's an experience to him. He actually got worse.
Subhanallah, right.
He got worse. With age, he became worse. So age itself is not a criteria. It is the view of that person, the way that that person looks at the world around him, young or old.
Mm-hmm.
For example, during the imposed war on the Islamic Republic by the whole world, you had 12-year-olds speaking like 40-year-olds. Very different.
Yeah.
People like Hussein Fahmide, for example. The name suits him as well, Fahmide.
Mm.
So you have these things. It's not age, it's not merely, it's just age, like Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, Hafizahullah, says that age is just the amount of times the earth has gone around the sun. What does that do to a person? It has no meaning. It's just the amount of times, what does that mean for you? It means nothing. Unless you take lessons from what you are actually experiencing.
It's a very good point.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
But we also have a hadith from the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, where he says, for example, respect those who are younger than you because they've committed less sins, and respect those who are older than you because they've done more a'mal.
Good.
And then we also have that hadith of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, alayhi wassalam, where they are performing their wudu, and they see that an older person has come and they're performing their wudu incorrectly. Rather than shame that person, they ask one another, am I doing my wudu correctly? To maintain the respect of that elderly person. And of course, he understood what they were doing, and it brought him closer to the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim wassalam. So there is this element of respect that we should have for elders, right?
Oh, definitely. But that's not because of the deeds of that person. That's because of my akhlaq.
Mm-hmm.
I respect you. Hopefully, inshallah, it'll be something that is good for me.
Mm.
You know, standing in a bus, if an old person comes, regardless of that, but we don't know that person, but we stand up, we give them the seat.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That looks good on us. Not to say that we do it for that, but it's something that is beneficial for us. For example, the respect of that particular thing is the first hadith that you mentioned is about husnizan.
Yeah.
Having, thinking well of others.
Mm.
They have this thing about you. It's to promote
the benefit of the doubt.
A benefit of doubt, thinking good about others. That, for example, the second, how to do tarbiyat, how to train people at different stages of their lives. For example, an elderly man is not going to listen to a youngster, right? That's what they're trying to show here. So there's a way and a method of how you do tarbiyat and development and to teach a person who's older. Like, for example, we have other traditions as well that Imam Ali alayhi salam would always welcome the elder into his home, and he would tell Imam Hassan, you welcome the youngster into our home. To keep that balance, so to speak, the social balance.
So it's coming back to you, sister. It's a rather a negative thought that sometimes people will grow older, but the experiences don't change them.
Yes.
Why do you think that happened?
You know, maybe there are two groups of people. Some change, as I said, some change their thoughts. Some become more spiritual. And the others are those whose nature stays the same. There are lots of people who are in this way. In fact, these are not exceptions. Lots of people who followed the way of thinking that they used to have as youngsters, as in the middle age, and even when they are aged. And so, as Brother Yasser correctly mentioned, Abi Lahab is a good example of a person who was shaqi from the beginning of his life, and he died shaqi. He died
arrogant.
Accepted that the old people are more spiritual. There are lots of people who are angry when they are young. They give their attention to the outside appearance. There are lots of characteristics that are related to young people. But as they get old, they become more quiet. Those who are angry become more quiet. Mm. Those who give lots of attention to their appearance, they change their mind and say, come on, I just have to be good.
Mm.
And these are the features that I personally believe that as they getting older, as we as people get older and older, come to realize these. And that's a good thing. That's quite appreciable.
Well, there's actually a hadith that you bring to my mind. It's from Imam Ali alayhi salam. Sheikh Yasser, if you can recall, he said that I would rather take advice from an elderly, experienced, wise man than a kind of hot-headed youth, warrior, to paraphrase. He used the word warrior?
A soldier, basically.
Soldier, okay.
Someone who's brave. Started the discussion was one of the hadith in my mind. One of the reasons for that hadith is that an old man or an old individual or an old person has a lot of life experience.
Hmm.
So you can learn from him. So again, the concept of learning, of seeing that individual in front of you as a means to better yourself, doesn't mean that the person in front of you has bettered himself. That the hadith doesn't say that. There's no indication of it that elderly person is, for example, an awliya of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Mm. The hadith doesn't say that.
Mm.
But what is definite that a person who is elder has had more life experience. That is something that is, you know, definite. It is something that is easily abstracted from the tradition.
Unless he's been in a coma for the first 30 years of
then
his life.
Then that's a different story. Yeah. Then it's just the same as a child who's just been born. So it is the concept of learning from the life experiences. Another one, it can be this one. Like if you really think about it, you can learn from the mistakes that person has made.
Yeah, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, I know history as though I lived it. And he, along those lines, he says, I learned from the mistakes of others to the point where I never committed those same mistakes.
So this hadith doesn't really point to the fact that elderly gentleman will have any status, but it's more about learning from their life experiences, the mistakes that this person has made, the journey that he has taken, the wrong turns that person has taken. Or, for example, the habits that he has gotten that he has never been able to get rid of.
I feel like you are pushing for this idea quite stringently, this idea that, you know, Islam doesn't push us to, you know, willy-nilly just give respect to elderly.
Give respect, but the respect is not for that person.
Obey. Why? Do you feel like this is a problem that we do have in the Muslim world?
Of giving respect, but respect is not due?
Yeah, I don't want to use the word respect because you end up respecting everybody anyway, right? But, I mean, this reverence.
Mm.
Reverence should be there for credit's worth, not for age worth.
Exactly.
Do you feel like that's a recurring theme that we feel?
Sometimes, look, our teachings tell us to respect regardless of who the elderly person is, right? So the Islamic teachings tell us that. But it doesn't mean that I respect you because of your age. I respect you, one, because of the teachings I have. That is why I respect it. A person should respect because of the sunnah of the Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. That's the principle, not age.
Yeah, but do you have like examples in the Muslim world where something's disgruntled you? Do you?
No.
I don't want to make you sound like you've got a chip on your shoulder. But
subhanAllah. Not really. It's just that Islam is a very principled religion.
Uh-huh, right.
It's based on principle. Mm. It's not like you mentioned, it's not willy-nilly, for example. Mm. Like, for example, the concept of parents, even if the traditions or the teachings of Islam teach us that, the Holy Quran teaches us clearly that even if your parent is not a Muslim, is kafir, you still have to respect them.
You have to be kind to them, yeah, you have to.
Not because of their age. Mm. Not because of anything.
Not obey them, but you have
to respect them.
Right. And again, that's for you, that's not for them.
Nothing to do. So most of the thing, like the respect that you are giving to an elderly person because of the principle, understand that these principles have a goal, you doing it is taking you towards that goal.
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. Sheikh Yasser and from Sister Zainab Sadat, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the Ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
U.S. authorities are questioning Americans flying to and coming back from Ukraine. Documents reviewed by Politico show that the U.S. government is gathering information about Americans who are planning to leave the U.S. for Ukraine and are tracking their activities after they return. That only backs up reports that American ultranationalists and white supremacists are moving to Ukraine to join the fight against Russia alongside those Russia brands as, quote, neo-Nazis.
This is the model that we've seen play out time and time again, going back to Libya and Afghanistan and Iraq and certainly Syria and other places. And of course, we'll see it play out again, because ultimately, in my opinion, what's happening in the Ukraine was made to happen inevitably by U.S. policy. And it's in effect another example of a proxy war, in this instance, between the U.S. And Russia.
But it appears that the political optics of the matter is of a secondary concern to U.S. authorities, who see the country's national security at a greater risk. Documents obtained from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection mention six unnamed Ukraine-bound Americans questioned at the airport who were either war veterans or had had military training. Two of the six were carrying military equipment. At least three had links to far-right groups. Amid the recent rise in gun violence and mass shootings in the U.S., the country would see deadlier attacks if the perpetrators have the experience of being in an actual war zone. Numerous studies, including those carried out by the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, refer to white supremacists as posing the greatest domestic terrorism threat to the country. The growing number of ethnically and racially charged attacks in the U.S. is raising fears that white supremacists trained in the Ukraine war could conduct even deadlier terrorist operations. Besides, many American citizens have traveled to Ukraine to provide military training to its army and militia, reinforcing the idea that Russian President Vladimir Putin's announcement that his country is fighting to denazify Ukraine isn't far from the truth.
To be sure, we've been seeing all manner of events play out for quite a number of years now, that established beyond any doubt that there are some hardcore extremists taking the fight to ethnic Russians in the eastern provinces of Ukraine. Thousands and thousands of Russians were killed, and President Putin, in addition to basically taking these moves to secure the boundary that separates Russia and the Ukraine, has stated that it's Russia's purpose to defend those individuals who are of Russian descent in the Donbas and in the Crimean Peninsula.
Russia has singled out the Azov Battalion, among other far-right Ukrainian paramilitaries, to bolster the idea that Nazis are within the ranks of the Ukrainian government and military. The U.S. used to agree with that, at least until as recently as 2018, when it banned the provision of U.S. military aid to the Azov Battalion over its links to neo-Nazis. According to the Washington Post, the Azov Battalion began recruiting far-right ultranationalist and white supremacist foreign fighters the day after Russia attacked Ukraine. The bottom line is, whether or not extremist Americans were sent by the U.S. government to fight the war in Ukraine, they're turning into problems for the country, both at home and abroad.
North Korea has fired 8 short-range ballistic missiles toward the sea off its east coast. South Korea says the missiles were fired from an area of the North Korean capital, Pyongyang. In recent weeks, North Korea has test-fired a range of ballistic missiles, including its largest intercontinental ballistic missile. The latest one comes just a day after South Korea and the United States wrapped up their first combined military drills involving an American aircraft carrier in more than 4 years. Pyongyang has frequently protested against Seoul and Washington's joint military exercises, calling them rehearsals for invasion, despite Washington's talk of diplomacy. The latest test marks the 18th time that North Korea has fired its missiles this year, including what the U.S. says was a failed intercontinental ballistic missile test on May 4th that exploded shortly after lunch. Last month, North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, said he would strengthen and develop his country's nuclear forces at the highest possible speed. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has failed to restart diplomatic talks with Pyongyang as tensions escalate. Former U.S. President Donald Trump attempted to court Pyongyang, but even though he met with the North Korean leader 3 times, he refused to relieve any of the sanctions in return for the several steps taken by Pyongyang toward denuclearization. That hampered further diplomacy between Pyongyang and Washington and prompted Kim to announce an end to a moratorium on the country's missile tests.
So it understands that a country that does not have a formidable arsenal can be subject to U.S. attack because it's considered weak. So this is part of it. Well, if it wants to remain the hermit kingdom, it must look to be strong and unpredictable, and this is how it uses its military, the projection of its military force.
North Korea, which has been under rounds of crushing UN sanctions since 2006 over its nuclear and ballistic missile programs, has ramped up its missile launches this year. The sanctions have led to rising levels of poverty and food insecurity. Despite the acknowledged food insecurity in North Korea, however, the United Nations Humanitarian Response Plan does not include an appeal for assistance to North Korea. A UN World Food Program report in 2019 concluded that 11 million of North Korea's 25 million people were undernourished, and 1 of every 5 children were stunted from lack of adequate nutrition. Last month, China and Russia vetoed a U.S.-led push at the United Nations to toughen sanctions on North Korea over its renewed ballistic missile launches. China, the North's closest ally, and Russia, whose relations with the West have sharply deteriorated over its military operation in Ukraine, said they would have preferred a non-binding statement instead of a fresh resolution against Pyongyang. Beijing warned that sanctions would cause an escalation and humanitarian consequences for North Korea, which has been recently hit by COVID outbreak. Meanwhile, Russia said Washington is ignoring Pyongyang's appeals to stop hostile activity. During the past 16 years, the UN Security Council has steadily and unanimously ramped up sanctions to cut off funding for North Korean nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. Since 2017, when the Council last stepped up sanctions on Pyongyang, China and Russia have been trying to ease sanctions on humanitarian grounds.
Because it's a coercive power. It doesn't want to treat another country on equal or humane terms, because, I mean, it doesn't want to preserve the current leadership of North Korea. It wants regime change.
In particular, China's strategic overture to North Korea since the collapse of U.S.-North Korea diplomatic talks in 2019 has drawn the two countries closer. With tensions rising over the U.S.-China competition and a new South Korean conservative government that vows to take a harder line on North Korea and China, Beijing has more incentive to keep Pyongyang close. Tehran has blasted the controversial visit by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency to Israel. The IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi, held talks with the Israeli regime's Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, in Tel Aviv, days after criticism of Iran's peaceful nuclear program. Iran's foreign ministry has warned of further erosion of the agency's credibility, while its director general kept silent on Israel's secret nuclear arsenal. Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said this questions the IAEA's impartiality. Grossi's visit to Tel Aviv came in the backdrop of a report by the IAEA alleging that Iran has not clarified the presence of nuclear material at three sites. Khatibzadeh, pointing to the UN nuclear body's blatant double standards, said the world powers cannot overlook Israel's weapons program while indulging in rhetoric about Iran's peaceful atomic program. Israel has never signed up to the Non-Proliferation Treaty that aims to ensure civilian use of nuclear technology. Tel Aviv possesses the largest number of nuclear warheads in the region and has never allowed IAEA inspectors to scrutinize its nuclear sites. On the other hand, Iran, despite being a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, continues to reel under harsh sanctions for pursuing a peaceful nuclear program. Earlier this week, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett accused Iran of stealing classified documents from the IAEA and using them to deceive international inspectors nearly two decades ago. Iran rejected the allegations as outright lies. The International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors is scheduled to hold a meeting on Monday with all eyes on the agency's latest report. The meeting is reportedly set to adopt an anti-Iran resolution drafted by Britain, France, Germany, and the United States to accuse the Islamic Republic of withholding cooperation with the agency. Israel backs the draft resolution to rebuke Iran by the IAEA Board of Governors. Tehran has warned against any unconstructive action at the upcoming meeting of the body, saying it will respond immediately and proportionately.
The right to resist this kind of bullying and coercion and sort of domination from the West, that right to resist is not allowed. You were never allowed to resist. And anything Iran does to preserve its independence is going to be labeled as dangerous and subversive somehow to the international order, and on and on and on.
Iran says the visit by the International Atomic Energy Agency's chief, Rafael Grossi, to Israel ahead of the meeting of the Board of Governors is in contradiction with the agency's principles of observing impartiality and maintaining its technical and professional status. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remarks in a phone call with the European Union's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, while pointing to the destructive measures of the Zionist regime, which is the main culprit of illegal nuclear activities in the world. Amir Abdollahian censured the, quote, hasty and unconstructive move by the U.S. and the three European countries, namely Britain, France, and Germany, in compiling a draft resolution at the IAEA. He said such behavior goes against diplomacy and will complicate the talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 deal between Iran and the world powers. He reiterated Iran's resolve to reach a good, strong, and lasting deal. Iran's foreign minister also said his country will immediately, effectively, and proportionately respond to any political move against Tehran at the International Atomic Energy Agency. Joseph Borrell, for his part, censured what he called some attempts to undermine the Vienna talks. He urged all the parties involved to continue the dialogue to change the current negative atmosphere pervading the IAEA. The Board of Governors meeting will come as a pause in the marathon negotiations to revive the 2015 Iran deal has entered its third month, with prospects described by Washington as tenuous at best. Tehran blames the US and its three European allies, France, Britain, and Germany, for failing to act constructively.
Tensions are once again rising in northern Syria as Turkey threatens to conduct a major military operation there. Ankara says it wants to establish a 30-kilometer safe zone along the Syrian border and push back terrorists. Turkey has long been fighting members of the People's Protection Units, YPG, a US-backed Kurdish militia it deems a terrorist group. Since 2016, Turkey has carried out three major incursions inside the Syrian territory under the same pretext, the latest of which came in October 2019, which fell short of ending in creating the buffer zone Ankara was hoping for. In the meantime, Damascus has slammed the Turkish plan as an act of aggression and an extension of Ankara's policy of ethnic cleansing in the area.
Turkey has been notorious for smuggling oil and engaging in oil theft in Syria. It has been launching military operations into Syria. It is indeed shot down and killed Russian military members in Syria. So Turkey has ambitions to expand its political footprint and reconquer parts of Syria that it lost after World War I. In the Sykes-Picot Act, which the French and the British carved up the Middle East after World War I.
Syria says the measures taken by Turkey have caused civilian casualties and done massive damage to public and private property, including critical infrastructure. Syria describes Turkey's offensive as a shameful act of aggression that has displaced dozens of families from their homes and villages. Russia has urged Turkey to refrain from launching an offensive into northern Syria, saying it could lead to a dangerous deterioration of the already difficult situation. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman said such a move would be a direct violation of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Maria Zakharova added that an incursion by Turkey could cause a further escalation of tensions in Syria. Iran's foreign ministry made a similar statement warning of humanitarian disasters and heightened tensions in the region. Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said, while the Islamic Republic understands Turkey's security concerns, the only way to alleviate those concerns is through dialogue and respect for bilateral agreements with neighbors. Turkey's face-off against the YPG would put Ankara in an uneasy position with the United States, which considers the Kurdish militia a major ally inside Syria. U.S. State Department on Tuesday said Washington condemns any escalation and supports the existing ceasefire lines in the area.